Good morning, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning to talk to you about the things, the subjects you raise by your telephone calls. If you have questions about the Bible, you may have questions about the Christian faith or about your own spiritual walk, your own spiritual journey. We'd be glad to talk to you about those things in the next half hour. It takes the time goes by very quickly, and therefore I urge you to call as early as you can. If you have a difference of opinion from the host, feel free to call about that. We'd be glad to hear from you. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Now, by the way, I've been making this announcement all week, but what are you doing Saturday night? We have a gathering in Temecula this Saturday night, not every Saturday, only about once a month. And I'm going to be giving a talk there, which you may enjoy hearing, or somebody you know may benefit from hearing. The talk is entitled, Why I Am Still a Christian. And it's going to deal with the objections that are very currently and commonly brought up against Christianity, and why it is that those are so unpersuasive. And it's my contention that I have much better reasons for being a Christian than anyone listening to me has for not being a Christian. And of course, that's kind of throwing down the gauntlet. If you think that's not true, that can be discussed. Be glad to hear from you or see you this Saturday night in Temecula. Now, the location, the address, the map, and all of that are at our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. And you go to the link that says announcements, and you'll see there the information about this Saturday night's gathering in Temecula. Let's talk to Richard from Seal Beach, California, first of all, today. And we do have a line open for you at 1-800-227-5278. Richard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you, Steve. My question is, Jesus said, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Now, in Leviticus, I believe it's chapter 20, it says homosexuals should be put to death. So should we still believe in that, or did something change? And I will hang up and listen to you on the radio. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, thanks for your call. Well, if you look to the Old Testament about the, what crimes and what sins are worthy of death in the Israeli society, that is one of them, but that's not the only one. There's lots of different sexual behaviors that were considered to be perverted and immoral and intolerable in the society of Israel in the Old Testament. That would include adultery. It would include bestiality. It would include homosexuality. But not only sexual sins. I mean, there were a number of crimes, sins against parents by their children. A child striking his parents or cursing his parents was a capital crime. Now, that seems a little harsh from our point of view. For one thing, lots of people today don't believe in capital punishment at all. And those who do would probably want to reserve it for murderers or people who've done things that we think of as serious like that. And surely the Bible does not require that non-Israelite societies adopt these rules. That is, what I mean is the rules of enforcing morality. The morality, I believe, of God is still the same. I believe that God is still opposed to sexual immorality of all kinds. But I don't believe that we are in a situation where we are expected to punish people for their sexual behavior, because we, the church, are not a government. We don't have a prison system. We don't have a law enforcement system as for the church. Only for our own members, there is such a thing as church discipline. But Israel was a country. Israel was a nation that had police and army and government officials and a criminal justice system and so forth. And God is the one who dictated what their criminal justice system should be like. Now, he even required that people be put to death if they blaspheme God or if they break the Sabbath. It's very obvious that many of these laws were associated with the special role that Israel had as God's covenant people. Israel, at their founding, agreed that they wanted to live in covenant relationship with God. He said, okay, well, these are the terms. If you're going to be a nation that glorifies me, these are the things that will glorify me. These are the things that have to be enforced. And so Israel did have criminal penalties for many crimes. Not all of them were capital punishment, but a great number were, between 20 and 30, I think. I've heard the number 30 and above as the number of total capital crimes in the Old Testament law. So, you know, when you bring up putting to death homosexuals, that's not just about homosexuals. That's just one of the many things, one of the many deviations from the law that was punishable by death. There were other criminal penalties, too. For example, a thief would have to repay his victim with interest, and so forth. Now, that being so, we have to realize that there is no nation today, no political nation, that has that covenant with God that Israel had. God made a covenant with Israel, and that was a type and a shadow of the spiritual Israel, the spiritual relationship that we have with God. And our relationship with him is spiritual as a church. It's not political. The church is not supposed to set up law courts and prisons and its own criminal justice system. The church is supposed to enforce morality within its ranks, but certainly we're not supposed to go out to the non-Christians and start arresting them for doing immoral things. That's not the task of the church. In fact, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5, he said, what do I have to do with judging those who are outside the church? He said, God judges them, but we must judge only those who are inside. So if we have people in the church who are living immorally or otherwise, you know, just flouting the standards of Christ and refusing to be obedient to him, well, then they should be put out of the church. That's the most we can do to them. We're not supposed to put them in jail or kill them or do anything like that. The church is not authorized to do that kind of thing, not by God and not by the state. So that's not what we would do. It is true, though, that that those things that God thought were wrong are wrong. That hasn't changed. The real question is whether Christians have the role of enforcement. And the answer is no. We don't have that role of enforcement that the Israelite judges had in their society. They had a political state and courts and laws. The church doesn't operate that way. The church is a spiritual fellowship. So although the scriptures do give many instructions to the magistrates of Israel, those instructions do not apply directly to any situation that the church finds itself in today, since we don't have a government like that. All right, we're going to talk to Art from Los Angeles next. Art, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question out here. If we look at the gospel, life of Jesus Christ, we all assume more or less that he lived on this earth for 33 years. And what is your imagery from Jesus Christ? I've just always tried to image myself, and if Jesus would live nowadays, you know, throughout his whole ministry out there, seemingly he was pretty well isolated. He didn't have no friends per se that I can see out of the Bible, but yet.
You mean when he was in the ministry or when he was not in the ministry?
Well, it's not or in whatever. There's a very little written when he was not in the ministry, but seemingly that he just actually suffered and died his last part of his life, more so, all by himself. There is no, except for his mother, and for I believe the only one is John, I believe, if I see this history. But the rest, yeah.
Well, I'm surprised you'd say he didn't have any friends, because he traveled with the apostles right up until a few hours before his death. It's true, most of his friends kept their distance from him once he was arrested. Yeah.
Right. That's exactly what I mean. I always make a difference between a friend and an acquaintance. Friend meaning, you know, that stood by you know, even those who has difficult. This is what I point trying to make. You're right. You may have a lot of contacts, but that really are willing to, you know, be with him.
The way I read it, Jesus' disciples, that is the apostles, who were, of course, 12 in number, were all loyal to him except one. And it's true that at the moment of crisis, they weren't as courageous to stand with him as friends really should. Though that may be true of many of the people we consider to be good friends, too. I mean, we have people that we probably regard as our good friends, not mere acquaintances. But when push comes to shove, if they were going to stick with us and die or go somewhere else, they might go somewhere else. I mean, lots of people are not friends unto death, and that's too bad. We should be. We should stand by our friends, especially we should stand by Jesus. And so we can say we can see a defect in his friends. But I wouldn't say he didn't have friends. The disciples, he said, you have been with me from the beginning. You know, you'll be my witnesses and so forth. And he says, I don't call you any more servants. I call you friends. And that's because they were his friends. I mean, they had given up everything to follow him. They even eventually gave up their lives. But at the moment he was arrested, their courage failed them. And they weren't very good friends at that moment. But that's kind of how people are, really. I mean, I have a number of friends who've been friends of mine for many, many years. And some of them, on occasion, have disappointed me. Sometimes they, you know, I could have stood some help from them, some support from them or whatever, some loyalty, and they just didn't show up with it. But I didn't write them off. I don't consider they're not my friends. So I'm not sure what you're getting at. It sounds like you're maybe wondering if I'm picturing Jesus as a lone wolf, you know, I mean, just a loner out there wandering around without anyone who understands him. Now, maybe what you're saying is that Jesus never really did have anyone who really did understand him. And that's probably true during his lifetime. His disciples didn't really understand him that well. Even in the upper room at the end of his life, he said, have I been such a long time with you, Philip, and you still don't know me? That is, there were things about him they didn't know, including who his deep identity was, that he and the Father were one. They apparently didn't realize that at that point. And when you're the Son of God and your best friends don't quite know that, then probably you feel like they don't know you all that well. And you probably wish they would. But at the same time, while Jesus definitely had to live with misunderstanding, even from his friends, even, you know, cowardice at times from his friends, in that respect, he wasn't much different than the rest of us. So most of our friends are going to let us down some of the time. I wouldn't disqualify them as friends. I would just say some friends are better than others. And some are. And these disciples, they became better friends as after the resurrection. And they understood more, too. And I think that helped. Anyway, that's about probably as much as I can spend time on that particular question. Let's talk to John from Los Angeles next. And also, we have a line open for you at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. John, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Steve. Why are Christian missionaries so caught up with converting Jews to Christianity? Why do they even care? I mean, they have Messianic synagogue and stuff like this, and what is that all about?
Well, Jesus told his disciples to go and make disciples of all nations, and that would include Jews. Jews are one of the, I mean, nations in the Greek is ethnoi, which means people groups, nationalities, and so the Jews are one nationality.
Jews, though. But they seem obsessed with Jews.
Well, actually, it seems to me like some Christians are obsessed with Jews, but not in the same sense as what you're saying. I don't know that the Jews have been targeted for evangelism more than other people groups have been. I think missionaries have been going to all the world, China and India, Africa, for many decades before there was very much outreach to Jews. I think many people feel the Jews are an important I think a lot of Christians feel the Jews are a very important people, a very important nation in the end times, and they are very eager to see Jews come to Christ, of course, partly because some people believe that's predicted and that if the Jews come to Christ, that'll more, hasten the second coming of Christ. I can't speak for everybody. I think some people see it that way. But as far as the church as a whole is concerned, I don't think the Jews have been targeted more than other groups for evangelism. I think there certainly are people who are reaching out to the Jews, but there's missionaries going to Muslims and to atheists and to, tribal peoples and so forth, too.
Well, there's over 200 to 250 messianic temples and synagogues in this country that are specifically targeting Jews. That's pretty large scale.
Now, when you say they're targeting Jews, I'm not sure what you mean. Let me tell you what I mean. There are many Jews who believe in Christ, and many of them like to meet in a Jewish sort of a way still, even though they're Christians, and so they have Messianic synagogues. I would say that the Messianic synagogues, though I've never attended one, is not primarily a means of evangelizing Jews, but a fellowship of Jewish people who happen to believe in the Messiah.
Well, let me educate you on that. These temples, and this is fact, you can check this out. These synagogues, quote synagogues, are funded by Christian organizations. Specifically, Moshe Rosen, Jews for Jesus, got most of his funding from Baptists. He was a Baptist minister.
I knew him.
Enormous amount of their funding from them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
in fact,
that's not too surprising.
You're saying, even though you didn't mean it, what you're saying is incorrect.
Well, I don't see how what you said makes what I said incorrect. I said I think that these are places where Christian Jews like to fellowship. Now, you said that they are funded by Baptists. I think, okay, that doesn't change what I said.
Well, if you take a look at what they put in their literature, they do all the trappings of Judaism and do not tell them what it's really about until a Jew actually is in there. And then all of a sudden they lay it out to them. They're not up front with it. In fact, they were actually put down by people like Billy Graham because they were deceptive. And I agree with them on that.
Well, I can't disagree only because I'm not familiar with the methods of the Messianic synagogues. I've never attended one. I have known a number of Messianic Jewish people, and they're all very upfront about the fact that they are followers of Christ. I don't know what the synagogue service is like. Maybe they do wait until later in the service to mention that they are following Jesus. I'm not sure. Are you a Jewish person who's attended one of these?
I have attended one of these. And if a Christian missionary is up front, that's great. That's fine. I can respect that. But when I've seen memos of people that have publicized things that they didn't want publicized, that were publicized as to, because for generations they were not able to convert Jews, so they tried a new method around 50 years ago, which are these Messianic synagogues. They weren't around in big numbers prior to that. They've mushroomed.
No, I suppose not.
Because this is their way of doing it.
Well, I'll tell you what I think their mentality is, and I'm not a Messianic. I'm not part of the Messianic movement. I'm a follower of Jesus. I believe he's the Messiah, but I'm not Jewish, and I don't necessarily go along with everything the Messianic movement does, so I'm not here as their defender, but I think I can say this about their motivation. I believe that they feel that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, and therefore they, as Jewish people, embracing the Jewish Messiah, have not ceased to be true to Judaism. In fact, they believe that every true Jew should embrace the Messiah, and in doing so, it doesn't make them not a Jew. It makes them a fulfilled Jew.
If the only thing that they differed on was the Messiah, I could see your point. But you can't just say Jesus is Messiah. If you become a, quote, Messianic Jew, that is the same as being Christian, and that's fine. That means you've got to believe in the Trinity. That believes you have to believe in the resurrection. And they, that's where they don't, that's where they differ from Judaism.
Well, I'm going to agree with you on one point. I will agree with you on one point at least, and that is sometimes Messianic Jews shy away from calling themselves Christians, and sometimes they even say, we're not Christians, we're fulfilled Jews. I've heard them say that. I've actually seen that in magazine articles they publish. They say, we're not Christians, we're fulfilled Jews. I disagree with them in that, because the Bible says that whether a person is Jewish or Gentile, when they follow Jesus, they become one body with all the other followers of Jesus, and there's no Jew or Gentile distinction within the Messiah. And so I think that sometimes, to the degree that Messianics may try to disown the name Christian in favor of something else, it may be because they're trying to conceal that they're Christian, but it may also be, in some cases, I think they consider themselves to be somewhat of a a special category within the Christian movement. I don't agree with either of those things. I think that Jewish Christians are not a special category. I believe that people who are Christians, regardless of their nationality.
I agree with you on that.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
And I must let you know, and before I get off, that that is a deceptive movement. And the fact is, they try to do all the trappings of Judaism, which, by the way, if you're Christian, you consider those, you know, wearing tefillin and kippah according to Christianity, there's no meaning to any of that. So the fact that they're doing it shows that they're trying to snare in Jews and then go, oh, by the way, we believe in Jesus too. It's very disingenuous.
Well, John, I can't say there are no deceptive evangelists out there or deceptive movements. There certainly are sometimes. I don't know. I can't answer for these particular ones. You tell me they're deceptive, so I'll just have to take your word for it. But I will say this, that some of the Jewish customs that they keep, I don't think they're doing it just to be disingenuous or just to be deceptive. I think they are interpreting those customs as being meaningful in light of their belief in Christ as the Messiah. But I can see that you object to their methods.
Listen, thank you for your time.
Okay, John, good talking to you. Thank you for your call.
All right.
Bye now. All right, our next caller is Steve from San Diego. Steve, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thanks. I got a question about the parable of the old and new wineskins. Now, I take it to mean that he's talking about his new covenant, so to speak, and then the old wineskin as meaning the old covenant, which he was still under. Well, I mean, you know what I'm saying. But at the end of that, he says the old is better. Now, that kind of throws me for a loop, because I don't know what is your take on that? Is he saying that the old covenant that existed in the before is better than what he's going to bring? I don't think that's true, but what do you make of that statement?
What Jesus actually says is that people who have drunk the old wine, they don't quickly want the new wine because they say the old is better. That doesn't mean that the old really is better, but rather that that's what people think. Those who are addicted to the traditions often think the traditions are better than the new movement of God. And I think that's what, I believe that's what he's referring to, is that lots of people who would otherwise be open to drinking what he calls the new wine are not open because they think they have something better already. This is how it goes in Luke 5:37, and no one puts new wine into old wineskins, or else the new wine will burst the wineskins and be spilled, and the wineskins will be ruined. But new wine must be put into new wineskins, and both are preserved. And no one, having drunk the old wine, immediately desires new, for he says the old is better. In other words, he basically is saying, people who are satisfied with their traditions are not going to be particularly interested in changing them or going for something new. They like what's old and familiar, And that's, I think that's true. That is true of human nature. But he's not saying that the old is better. He's saying that's the attitude of people who are pretty much satisfied with the old. Now, in the context, the Pharisees and the disciples of John the Baptist were asking Jesus why his disciples don't fast like they do. Now, it's interesting that fasting was not part of the Old Covenant. It was part of the Jewish traditional behavior, but it was not part of what the Old Covenant commanded, except on the Day of Atonement. The Jews were supposed to fast on the Day of Atonement, but no other time were they required to do so under the law. And yet, when Jesus was asked, why don't your disciples fast, part of his answer is you don't take new wine and put it in old wineskins. Now, a wineskin, you know, but many of our listeners may not know, a wineskin was made of goatskin. It was a bag, a bottle made with goatskin. And they had put fresh wine, unfermented, into it, and they'd seal it up. And as the wine would ferment, it would expand. It would put off gases and so forth. It would expand, and the wineskin, because it was made of leather, would stretch. And it would accommodate the growth or the expansion of the wine. However, once that had happened, the wineskin was pretty much stretched to capacity. Once you've drunk that wine out of it, you don't put new wine in it and do it all over again with the same wineskin because it's too brittle. It's too stretched out. So he said, when you have new wine, you don't put it in old skin because it'll break the skin and you'll lose the wine and the wineskin. So you put it in new wineskins. I believe what Jesus is saying is this, that the Pharisees and John the Baptist were thinking of religion in an old way, a structural, rigid, inflexible way, and that Jesus was coming with a new dynamic, the life in the Holy Spirit. It was not going to be basically governed by or defined by rules and structures like religion is. It's going to be a dynamic, living thing, and he was not willing to confine it in the structures of old religious practices, whether it's the practices of the Old Covenant or even the traditional practices of the Pharisees and so forth. Anyway, I'm sorry we're out of time. I'm going to cut off here in about 30 seconds. This question is not fully answered yet, but I appreciate you asking it. We can talk again in the future. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. We pay for the time on the radio, and we get all that to pay with from people like you, or else we go off the air. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. If you'd like to help us out, you can check that out, thenarrowpath.com, and tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue our discussion. God bless you.
Hello, good morning. This has been today's The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. This live interactive call-in program is so exciting because your real-life questions get answered by someone who has a long history of being able to get into the heart of what you're trying to find out and giving you an answer that you can, you know, perhaps not only just live with and understand, but pass it on to others. So it's great that this program is out there and the fact that we all get to learn from each other. But, you know, this program won't stay on the air if people don't support it. It's really that simple, and that's why we ask you every day at this time to please support The Narrow Path. We want Steve's ministry to continue right here on KBright, but we need our listeners to participate. So if you would like to be able to give to The Narrow Path and give to Steve's ministry, then please go to Steve's website, thenarrowpath.com. It's a very easy website to navigate. You'll be able to find a place very easily where you can give. However, if you need additional contact information for the ministry and you'd like to give in another way, please call us at 800-227-2337. That's 800-227-2337 to be able to get additional contact information for The Narrow Path for Steve. And we'll be sure and give all that info to you, and you can give in whichever way you would like to choose. Again, please remember that the views and opinions on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, its ownership, management, or its advertisers. Up next, it's Joyce Meyer on AM 740, KBright.
Today on The Bottom Line, the Answers in Genesis Ministry just raised $150 million to build a replica of the Ark. Could that money have been put to better use? We'll take your calls on that subject today at 3. Plus, a Tennessee judge has just been severely reprimanded for forcing a mother to change her child's name. Frankly, I'm with the judge on this one. I'm Roger Marsh. These stories and more today at 3 on The Bottom Line on AM 740 KBright.
The oldest and largest Christian station in Southern California, 50,000 watts strong. KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa, and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching on confidence with the teaching titled The Cure for the Insecure. Have you ever asked yourself, who am I? When you search for an identity and find that you are not sure about the person you are. Being confident in oneself is a challenge that you may face daily. Whether it be in your job, your family, or even in the body of Christ, God knows who you are. And if you learn to trust in Him, He will give you the confidence and blessing to know who you are and that you are following His will for your life. Listen today as Joyce shares what the cure is for insecurity, the peace, joy, and righteousness in God. Now here's Joyce with today's teaching, The Cure for the Insecure.
So you can't enjoy life if you don't have any peace. So let's just start down here and say, okay, if you're not enjoying your life, what? So we kind of try to bypass the things that we need to have, and we skip in the middle, and we jump all the way over here to, well, I know why I'm not enjoying my life, because I need a promotion at work. Come on now. I know why I'm not enjoying my life. I need a bigger house. I know why I'm not enjoying my life. I'm not married, and I'm tired of being alone, and if I was just married, I would enjoy my life. Well, maybe. Hey, I love being married, but, you know, it doesn't come without going through some things once in a while. We're pretty much through all that. You know, just if you're